Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu, and today I'm joined by Katie Bors and the New Statesman Stephen Bush. Now, we had our first cabinet this morning where Boris Johnson met with his new cabinet ministers. Katie, how did that meeting go?
So there are several, I think, takeaways from the first meeting of Boris Johnson's new look cabinet. I think the thing that's triggering the most amusement is the fact that Boris Johnson engaged in a call and response. And in this, we saw the Prime Minister going to some of his favourite pledges that he likes to bring up at any opportunity. So how many hospitals are we going to build? Stephen, Cindy, do you want to answer this
40.
One? 40. Okay, well done. I'm being the Prime Minister. How many more police officers?
20,000.
The messages are really landing here. That's right. How many more nurses?
40.
It's 50,000. So I think we all have work to do to get.
Depends on retainment, though, doesn't it?
Cabinet. So I think it adds to this image. If you look at the reshuffle yesterday, something we've spoken about, the fact that ultimately there is this focus to make ministers very compliant, to centralise power in number 10, this idea that perhaps you don't have that much freedom of choice if you're a Secretary of State in terms of your own department, in terms of policies. It has to be in sync with number 10. I think this call to arms and the response, I think, is adding to that image. But I also think that if you look at everyone in this cabinet, they are in large very relieved to still be there, and people did look very enthusiastic that they are in that meeting. When it comes to, I suppose, the meaty stuff from today's gathering, you ultimately have a situation where it was all about immigration. So the cabinet have in theory given the green light to Boris Johnson's plans for an Australian style points-based immigration system, which is going to be in place allegedly from January 2021. And he's also, they agreed, a guarantee that it would lead to lower immigration overall. Now, how they're actually going to do that is a different issue for a different time, and they didn't get into that level of detail. But clearly the focus is the point that this is what they are heading for, and we are heading for an aim to have lower immigration. I think that when it comes to cabinet signing things off, we are entering a stage where, yes, they signed off just like cabinet signed off HS2, but you don't really think the decision was made around the cabinet table. Mm. A little bit like the address at the beginning, you know what the ministers are going to say if Boris Johnson asks them to, because his stock is so high. And I think that the majority of 80 right now and the way that number 10 have taken control means that this is ultimately just a process stage rather than actually trying to get your ministers to change their minds or convince them.
In other words, a rubber stamping. Stephen, do you think this cabinet is going to continue being so compliant? Are there any people in there who you think might cause trouble or any sign of dissent in the days to come?
No, I mean, I think the cabinet won't continue to be this compliant. I mean, last week in my NS column, I sort of wrote that, yeah, we're in this kind of unipolar moment in British politics, like the sort of unipolar moment after the end of the Cold War in 1989, that period in which the US was the only superpower. Mm. And of course, the US is very much not the only superpower anymore. And just as there are lots of events that we couldn't necessarily have identified in 1989, what will be the things which end this moment? But there's a reason why Charles Krauthammer called it a unipolar moment. He knew full well that the US's era of total dominance would not last forever. And there are a couple of things which we can sort of say for certain will change the kind of current dominance. The first is if you ask any chief whip, past or present, do you like reshuffles? Mm. The first thing they will say is, no, I would prefer it if the Prime Minister or the Leader of the Opposition never reshuffled. Because every time you do a reshuffle, two things happen. One, you sack people. And although the majority of people who were sacked or opted to resign yesterday will genuinely continue to be loyal, not all of them will be. One of the reasons why this majority of 80 feels so much bigger than Tony Blair's final majority of 66 is not because the extra 7 rebels you'd need to defeat the government are so much sort of, you know, are harder to come by. It's because by the time Tony Blair had got his majority of 66, he'd fired more than 66 people, and they were more likely to rebel, and that made it harder for them to get things through. And so the big thing is, right, you know, there will be more reshuffles, and kind of every reshuffle you do sort of weakens you a little bit. The other sort of kind of cloud on the horizon, of course, is the sources of Boris Johnson's dominance is, one, the idea he's going to be around for a long time, and two, the idea that the Labour Party is on its back. And I don't want to kind of, you know, sort of foreshadow slightly what we'll talk about later, but even if politics sort of goes back into its kind of usual sort of pre-Tony Blair pattern, and indeed post-Tony Blair pattern, of the Labour Party leading in midterm and then losing when the actual election happens, that weakens the sitting Prime Minister a bit. The other thing is that, yeah, the thing I've been really struck by about this reshuffle and about cabinet in general is I realised this morning what it really reminds me of is a successful opposition. Mm. Not because of its positioning or because of anything it's saying, but because what tends to happen with a successful opposition is that's mostly when a party leader is at their strongest, not when they've first been elected by the country, but when they've first been elected party leader. And then they do mostly do all of the things this government has done, like go, well, we get to pick your special advisors, well, we have command and control over what you do. And they grow weaker and weaker. They will grow weaker and weaker for several reasons. One is that, you know, if even, say, Tony Blair, peak of his powers in 1994, by 1997, you had people like Mo Mollam, who were really popular in the country, and it would have been very difficult, even if he'd wanted to sack. You had people like Gordon Brown, who, again, were slightly, feel slightly weird to say looking back, who were very popular in the country, ignoring the kind of... Then, of course, you have the difficulties of filling certain jobs, of which the new Attorney General is a really good case in point. Now, Suella Braverman, I don't think even her strongest fans could say, was as qualified an Attorney General as Geoffrey Cox, you know, one of the most accomplished lawyers in Parliament. Ultimately, though, you've got to be a lawyer to do that job. So once you've got rid of Geoffrey Cox... If Suella Braverman does something, you know, if some new event was to happen and divided the Conservative Party and Suella Braverman is on one side of it and Boris Johnson is on the other, it actually is a lot harder to sack Suella Braverman, not because she's suddenly become much more qualified, but to be honest, because it's a difficult job to fill. That's particularly going to be acute with the new Chancellor. So I think genuinely, if you ask me to pick, where do I think the trouble will come? Mm. Well, it will still be with the Economic Department, right? Yeah, I think Boris Johnson's entirely right to sort of single out, as far as effective political units go, the David Cameron, George Osborne duopoly. But you can't achieve that through organisational change alone. It's partly a function of events, personal relationships, and the fact that this is still a government which has, I mean, I was about to say a very tight spending set of fiscal rules, but it has... It is promising to spend more at a point in the economic cycle when it's usually quite difficult, having ruled out most tax rises. It doesn't really matter how sort of a bully and congenial and clever your chancellor is, even though they have got a chancellor who is a bully and congenial and very clever, liked by his civil servants, liked by the Downing Street political team. A pretty impressive balancing act, that. But it's still going to be a very difficult relationship, I think, in some ways.
Katie, you've written a really interesting Guardian column today.
Thank you, Cindy.
In which you say that now that the government has centralised power, it can't avoid any responsibility for what it's going to do next. There's no one to blame. Do you think Dominic Cummings could be the sort of evil advisor sort of role that Boris Johnson, when going got tough, could say it was his fault, not mine?
Well, I think there was an interesting graph this week in the Times Red Box email, actually. Sorry, Stephen, to plug a rival morning newsletter.
Although, actually, you can't sign up to that one without being behind their paywall now. So,
Okay, so it's acceptable.
Obviously, the evening blend from The Spectator is the best one.
Yeah, I think we do that. People read a morning email as well as the evening one. But it's hit and miss. Anyway, it was an interesting graph. Basically, what they had done was worked out the number of mentions of every cabinet minister in recent newspaper articles. And this is in part because we know number 10 is not particularly keen on cabinet ministers being... too much in the news. They think they should be at their desks, not mixing with journalists. And they found that the individual who has named the most in media reports is actually Dominic Cummings, more than any cabinet minister. Now, I think that he attracts and draws a lot of attention, but I personally think it will be hard for Boris Johnson to blame decisions on someone he has hired to be his senior advisor. And I also think what this reshuffle shows is
people might like this idea that they can just say, you know, there's one person calling all the shots. There are many people in number 10 who are influential. You know, yes, there's Dominic Cummings. There's also Muneera Mirza, who leads a policy unit, who's previously worked for Boris Johnson. So, you know, Eddie Lister. There's a host of people who are all feeding in. I think the point I was getting at in that piece is, I think what's been quite striking about the way Boris Johnson and his team operate is what they did very successfully in the general election was, even though the Tory party have been in government for years, to the point where actually some of their policy decisions have now borne results and not all of them have been good, they managed to bat it off quite easily by saying, this is a new government. Boris Johnson, in the interview to James and myself, The Spectator, was talking about how he wouldn't have gone as far on austerity measures as David Cameron did. So you can see them putting this clear blue water. I think even with Sajid Javid, there is a sense where, probably, you know, the way HS2 was pitched and things, but there was someone to blame a bit. I do think by centralising power to this degree, Boris Johnson has taken full responsibility. Now, he may manage to find ways to still say nothing to do with me, Gov, on certain issues. But I do think going into the next election, I mean, it's going to be harder to blame secretaries of states even for mishaps if ultimately they don't have enough freedom to pursue their own interests. So I do think that this reshuffle, number 10, has got what it wants from it. But with great power clearly does come great responsibility, and I think it'll be harder for them to push off stuff in the way that I think characteristically they've done pretty well up to now. You know, the fact that you hear this Conservative government often talking about, you know, restoring it, going back to being the party of law and order, talking about how they are the ones creating law and order on the streets, but ultimately violent crime has risen since the Tories have been in government. Now, they can give you lots of reasons why they think that is, but I think that there is that space between the two, and I think it's going to be harder to do in the years to come.
And Stephen, while we have you here, it's nice to have you here. We haven't talked about the Labour leadership much on this podcast in the midst of Huawei and HS2 and reshuffle.
I don't think anyone has.
So can you catch us up on what's been happening there?
So, I mean, what is happening is Keir Starmer continues to have a very large lead. Essentially, you know, every time a bit of the Labour Party has an open and uninterfered with vote, it mostly tends to vote for Keir Starmer. Actually, I mean, today, for example, you have two good cases in point. The Transport and Salaried Staffs Association, which is essentially the trade union for, basically, if you have a white-collar job working for a transport organisation, so if you are someone who does IT for National Rail, your trade union is the TSA. So they don't do many of the kind of drivers, but almost all of the stuff which you would apply to grad scheme to work in transport, you're represented by the TSSA. Now, they are traditionally have been a trade union on the left of the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. Their executive we would describe as being sort of pro-Corbynite. They opted to have a ballot of their members, and their members have voted to back Keir Starmer. The Jewish Labour movement, for obvious reasons, the part of the Labour Party which has felt most alienated from the Corbyn leadership, had a vote, and it voted to back Lisa Nandy. Not particularly surprising, considering she's the only backbencher on the field. But again, Keir Starmer very, very close behind, which is particularly, you know, kind of shows you the breadth of the coalition that Keir Starmer has built among the members. So I think it's pretty certain that Keir Starmer will win unless, and this is a pretty big unless because it is the Labour Party, unless there is some form of dirty tricks. And effective dirty tricks. Yeah, because we shouldn't forget, right, Jeremy Corbyn was not the candidate of the party establishment in 2015. And there were various things which people hoped would prevent him winning, but none of them worked. And there have been various things already that have been semi-designed to prevent Keir Starmer from winning. They don't appear to have worked either. But it's possible, of course, that some kind of internal chicanery can stop him winning. But I think, you know, just to completely agree with everything Katie just said about, you know, one of the particularly effective things that they did in the last election, the Conservatives, is they were able to be the change, right? Yeah. You know, you had a situation in which Labour had the same shadow foreign secretary, same leader, same shadow chancellor, and a completely different Tory party. Dynamic very similar to 1992. But one of the ways that the next Labour leader's life will be easier, and I think crime is exactly the issue, right, is the Labour Party has a problem, has always historically had this problem, that it's a kind of, when it wins elections, it successfully holds together its two core votes, so that kind of socially liberal, the kind of the Islington of tabloid cliche, that kind of voter, with, you know, people living, you know, in poverty. It's, again, actually, in many ways, a place more like the real Islington. and it successfully holds those together, and that's how it ends up with 200 seats, like we saw last month, 2 months ago even. When it wins, it's when it can add a chunk of the Conservative vote. And the thing that traditionally successful Labour parties have is they have a strong offer on crime. And the thing that, interestingly, Keir Starmer has managed to do is he's managed to avoid, at any point in this leadership election, saying anything which blocks him off having that strong offer on crime. And I think it will be more difficult at the next... Well, I think one of the reasons why why Jeremy Corbyn had an easier job than Ed Miliband, although he didn't do a particularly good job of leveraging that towards the end, and Tony Blair had an easier job still than Jeremy Corbyn in some ways, even though he was also a much more effective politician, was that crime had gone up quite a lot. And I think it's why... In many ways, the Labour leadership is sort of interesting, but what really matters is has crime gone down? Is the NHS in better state? And again, in terms of that question we were asking earlier about who's going to emerge to challenge him, the interesting thing is I don't think that Boris Johnson could sack Priti Patel because I think she's so important to that coalition, to the electoral coalition in so many different ways. She obviously is someone who is an authoritarian to her fingertips and has real credibility on that. I do think it helps in terms of the other end of the Conservative coalition. I think there are liberal Conservative voters who broadly like them. There are quite a lot of ethnic minorities at the top of the party and would, I think, be turned off if a white bloke was saying the things that Priti Patel is saying. And I just think that she is probably actually the unsackable minister at the moment. And that does show why governments become less powerful Prime Ministers become less powerful because successful governments have popular ministers and popular ministers can't be sacked.
That's a great note to end on. Katie and Stephen, thanks very much. And just a reminder that the application for podcast producer ends at the end of this month. So if you'd like to apply, do check out how@spectator.co.uk/podcastjob. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.